Thank you very much. It is amazing to see such a crowd of people who are interested in Methodism. In the world in which I live, that just doesn't happen. And I was staying with a friend last night who looks rather askance at my ongoing interest in Methodism, and she said, "Be sure you've got some jokes to put in every now and then to make sure they're still all awake." I don't have any jokes. I don't think John Wesley went for jokes either. You who are preachers will probably have quite a share of those, because I gather, at least in my tradition, a joke sometimes begins a sermon. But my address is quite earnest. But like the traditional sermon, I'd like to cover 3 points. And first of all, why I chose this topic and some of the challenges that are part of the topic. Secondly, some misunderstandings that people have had, maybe some of you as well, about Methodism in Canada during the latter part of the 19th century. And then I want to present some contrary evidence through the experience of a few individuals, and I want to set them in their wider social, political, cultural context. And finally, and this may be a bit controversial, but controversy is good for Methodists, I'd like to give a few thoughts how awareness of spirituality and its changing context might offer us some insights and opportunities for our own time. And I'm especially interested in your feedback since, you know, you are clergy, unlike an academic like myself. So why this topic? Well, spirituality is a topic that's hard to examine at any time, and certainly so in the past. And I've got a definition up there for it. It's a very simple one. More often than not, spirituality gets forgotten when historians do a quick sweep of Christian history. It's easier to focus on the writings of great preachers and theologians, and then we look at the past through their eyes, through the eyes of the preacher or the theologian. Spirituality can't be quantified like institutions. You can't analyze it the way you analyze doctrine. And those who practiced it in the past can't be interviewed, and you certainly can't poll them. So we have to study spirituality through the few accounts that we do have of people's experience, the way they've written about it in diaries, letters, biographies, and other published works. When Dr. Pedler asked me for a topic and title, I happened to be reading a recent work by one of my favorite cultural historians. His name is Robert Orsi, and he studies religion as lived experience, so not so much as belief, but as experience. And Orsi's interest is largely in Roman Catholics. And in his latest book, the one I was reading, he looks at the many ways in which Roman Catholics in the 19th and 20th centuries experienced the presence of the divine. Some of his examples are appearances by the Virgin Mary. She seemed to appear quite frequently in the 19th century. Visits to shrines, veneration of saints, and, of course, the belief of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. All the examples he lists were precisely those areas where Roman Catholics and Protestants strongly differed. Protestants would have nothing to do with the doctrine of transubstantiation. They saw the veneration of Mary and the saints as idolatry. They dismissed the sacred nature of the priesthood and the papacy, and they were strongly critical of the church's control over the reading of the Bible. It's not surprising, therefore, that given such dismissal of their valued spiritual practices, Roman Catholics saw Protestants as totally lacking any experience at all of sacred presence. As Robert Orsi succinctly summarizes the difference between the two, to be Catholic equals sacred presence, to be Protestant equals sacred absence. We know, of course, that such a stereotype was and is quite misinformed. And you who are in the Wesleyan holiness tradition will have no trouble in providing examples of sacred presence in revivals and in the lives of preachers and lay people. And the same can be said for Wesley's followers in early 19th century Canada. And I'd like to give you a description of one of those experiences, the first mass camp meeting held in 1805 in central Canada at Hay Bay, on the Bay of Quinte. And it's written, you may be familiar with this already, but it's written by Methodist Episcopal itinerant Nathan Bangs, and this is how he described it. "It might be said of a truth that the God of the Hebrews has come into the camp, For the noise was heard far off, the groans of the wounded, the shouts of the delivered, the prayers of the faithful, the exhortations of the courageous penetrated the very heavens and reverberated through the neighborhood. End of quote. Preacher's accounts of the early 19th century, whether it was in Upper or Lower Canada, the Maritimes, or Newfoundland, are filled with such stories of divine presence. Possibly some of those stories are more exuberant than John Wesley would even have been comfortable with. And you'll find similar accounts almost a century later by holiness preachers in Eastern Ontario and Western Canada. And you may still, I'd love to talk to you afterwards, you may still be experiencing this. But what about Nathan Bang's successors, the mainline Methodists in the years after 1850? Historians who have written about the period have argued that by the 1850s and 60s, Methodists were no longer looking for divine presence. The argument that the historians put forward is that in their desire to become respectable and accepted, Methodists lost their experience of the sacred. They abandoned the old exuberant religion of the heart in favor of college-trained ministers and orderly services in impressive Gothic and Romanesque-style churches, churches which we still see throughout the landscape. What mattered now was Methodist influence at the center of political power in the newly formed Canadian nation. Now, my own research and writing has been on Methodism in the second half of the 19th century, right up until the time that the mainline Methodists joined the United Church of Canada in 1925. I've looked at family papers, accounts of Methodist practices, doctrinal emphasis, and theological training, and I disagree strongly with the view that the denomination had lost its spiritual core. In the process, I've also become more aware of the complexity and tensions that are part of trying to understand spirituality in a changing context. And on this last topic, I'd like to offer a few reflections at the end of the talk. So, are you still awake? All right. No joke, but we continue. We today know something of the speed of change caused by the internet, social media, and advanced technology. We know how it's made our lives so very different from that of previous generations, even the generation of our parents. In a different way, but just as comprehensively, life changed for 19th century Canadians and Methodists after mid-century. When people's, and this is my main theme, when people's everyday experience changes, their spirituality or experience of the sacred also expresses itself in new forms that reflect their changed communal and self-identity. Our world changes, and our spirituality, which is our experience of God in the world, also changes. So what was the new context? By the 1850s, the relatively humble status of Methodists, especially in the villages and towns, had really changed a lot. It now included a number of professionals, well-to-do entrepreneurs, tradesmen, and farmers. Most now listed Canada as their country of birth. This shift in membership status and was part of a wider socioeconomic restructuring, which was brought about by canal and railway construction, large-scale immigration after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and rising farm input. So, you know, the frontier became much more settled. In Ontario, between 1851 and 1871, the number of people living in places of 1,000 or more almost tripled. New Brunswick's Methodists became the fastest growing religious group in that colony, and most were respectable tradesmen, and their prosperity was beginning to find expressions in new places of worship constructed in the impressive Romanesque and Gothic styles. In central Canada, Methodists were becoming the province's most prolific builder of churches, increasing the number of churches by fivefold. So you can imagine what an impact that would have on the community to see themselves growing so quickly. The perception that these changes were accompanied by spiritual decline comes largely from the warnings and reminiscences of an older generation of preachers. They look back with nostalgia on what came to be seen as Methodism's heroic period, the years of camp meetings in frontier settlements, dramatic conversions, and self-sacrificing itinerant preachers. Such lamentations are familiar in times of change. David Hempton, who is a historian of Irish Methodism, lovingly labels these men the old croakers. And some of us have become old croakers. Old croakers, preachers trained in an earlier period who have lost influence and find themselves out of step with the times. In actual fact, far from losing spiritual vitality, the 1850s were a period of intense revival. In central Canada, between 1849 and 1859, the membership of the Wesleyan Methodist Church more than doubled, from roughly 24,000 to roughly 51,000. And that of the Methodist New Connections almost doubled as well, from 3,389 to 5,708. In the Maritimes, Methodism grew little during this decade, but suddenly in 1859, over 3,000 new members came in, largely through revivals, not in the country, but in such major urban centers as Halifax, St. John, and Charlottetown. And Methodist connectional funds, funds for the entire denomination, not counting local funds, doubled during the decade. Now, one reason why some of the old croakers may have looked with nostalgia to the primitive simplicity of the past was that lay influence had also increased. Lay influence increases, influence of the clergy tends to decrease. Lay people demanded a better educated ministry, more reflective, less emotional preaching, and some wanted a reform of the class meeting. Some saw the class meeting's reliance on personal testimonies as becoming stale. Same old, same story, old, you know, repetition of my conversion story. And they saw that as a deterrent to drawing in new members. In 1874, laymen for the first time were granted seats in the General Conference as an inducement to try to get the New Connection Methodists to unite with the Wesleyans to form the Methodist Church of Canada. The denomination's well-to-do male members took on prominent roles nationally and also at the local level. The denomination was expanding, and so they played a vital role as church trustees, members of building committees, fundraisers, and stewards. Their wives and daughters served in providing poor relief, Sunday school teaching, and other forms of outreach. As a result, the 1850s brought profound changes among ministry and laity. As self-conscious modernizers, a new generation of laity and clergy went about building churches, founding colleges, establishing periodicals and newspapers, constructing new disciplines, and forming committees. In this process, especially in urban centers, ministers wanted to ensure that material progress did not happen at the expense of spiritual growth. That's always the danger, right? We become rich and we lose our spiritual core. And so ministers realized this would require a renewal of lay spirituality in a form more fitting for the times. How did this happen? Very simply, and very much in keeping with Methodist identity. The 1850s saw a revitalization of John Wesley's teaching on Christian perfection. This would have a profound impact on denominational leaders, such as theologian and Victoria College Chancellor Nathaniel Burwash, and Albert Carman, who after 1883 became the general superintendent of the Methodist Church of Canada. And you can tell by their dates of death as well that they had an extensive influence because they died in old age, and in those days you didn't retire. You died in harness, and they held on. So it shaped the leaders, the doctrine of Christian perfection. It also shaped many lay leaders, so clergy and leaders. In earlier accounts, there are references to Christian perfection, entire sanctification or holiness, but they're really few and far between because most of the emphasis is on conversion and the accompanying experience of the witness of the Spirit. But it was especially the efforts of two American revivalists, James Caughey and Phoebe Palmer, who instilled in Methodist audiences a new interest in Christian perfection. In 1857, Palmer came to Hamilton, Ontario, and it was the first of a series of Canadian visits. Religion was big news in those days, and the press always covered it, and revivalists made very good use of always contacting the press. And the way Palmer billed her revival method in the Hamilton Spectator was as a laity for the times. And as she explained to the newspaper, two things made her revival a success: the practical nature of revival and the role of organization and discipline among church members. And the way she describes it, she came to a regular weekly prayer meeting in the evening. There were about 50 to 75 people there. And in the course of her talking, somehow the spirit started to move, and quite a number of businessmen stood up and they said, "We are going to tithe, and we are going to bring one new member to tomorrow night's prayer meeting." So it was quite disciplined, quite well organized, and as a result, the next night this happened, and as a result, 18 days of meeting afternoon and evening took place, and the church apparently was overflowing with people. And similar accounts emerged from her impact in other urban centers and also the preaching of James Caughey. Their methods were part of a shift that matched the world of the laity. I think that's important. Revivals were sober in style. They called on the cooperation of wives and sisters, the importance of the family. And in these ways, they targeted a middle class who was active in the new commercial and industrializing marketplace. Starting in New York City, and also involving Palmer, a number of American large urban centers experienced similar revivals in the late 1850s. And the press describes these as the businessmen's revivals. Holiness was now experienced as a heightened sense of the sacred, an abiding experience of God's love that went beyond the emotional moment of conversion. It expressed itself in a daily structuring of one's time in ways that were practical and service-oriented. Earlier accounts of revivals by ministers had emphasized the emotional experience of the witness of the Spirit in conversion, but they hadn't talked very much about what happened to the convert's life after conversion. Accounts now took pains to note the absence of emotional manifestations in revivals, the disciplined involvement of the laity, and the consistent practice of piety as the test of conversion. Thanks to an interest in biography, especially among lay lives, men and women, for this period, a number of converts have left behind a rich description of their experience and subsequent religious practice. And I'd like to talk about three of these very briefly. Most of the new converts had already since childhood been socialized in evangelical Christianity. And so there are no vivid accounts the way there are of the earlier period of a misspent youth. Once I was a sinner. They realized they were sinners, but it was a different kind of sense of sinfulness. So here's the first one, and it's Charles Colby. In the village of Stanstead in Quebec and Eastern Townships, Charles Colby, in 1858, a young lawyer, fell in love with a young Methodist woman from Vermont. And shortly after that, he experienced a profound experience of divine love. And as he wrote to his new mother-in-law, although he'd been raised in a Christian home, he confessed that his knowledge of God had always been intellectual rather than experiential. Suddenly, as he experienced God's goodness and love, his relationship with the divine had changed. In his words, "All the barriers which had previously separated me from the Savior had come down, and for the first time in my life, I was able to enter into prayer as an intimate dialogue with God." He realized that God's nature was love and that religion was primarily a matter of the heart rather than the head. And of course, this intersected with the experience that he had also had of recently falling in love and planning to marry and start a family. He did marry, he did start a family, he was a devoted husband and father, and like so many others in this period, it was a really turbulent economic time, and Charles Colby lost his house at one point in time. He became insolvent. He was often away on business. He entered politics, and he served his country's federal parliament from 1867 to 1891. And even though he was often away from home, he maintained an active interest in the welfare of Stansted's Methodist congregation. He was a member of the management committee. He kept an eye on the stationing committee's selection of preachers to ensure that they always met his congregation's needs. You weren't supposed to do that, but they all did it. And with a view to the education of his four children, he was also an enthusiastic supporter and trustee of Stansted Wesleyan College when it opened its doors in 1874. Moving then to Halifax, James Bain Morrow. He was raised in a devout Methodist family. At age 16, he started to work for the Samuel Cunard Steamship Company, and he worked for there in a number of very influential positions for the rest of his life. After attending a series of revivals at a Sunday school at Argyle Street Methodist Church, he came home and he wrote in his diary in 1851, "I find the service of Christ to be perfect freedom, and I have to rejoice in what I experience of the love of God." And shortly after that, he took the leadership of a young boys' class, and he began a long career of active church involvement, which included lay preaching, teaching a Sunday, Saturday evening band meeting, leading a Sunday evening band meeting, assistance in church extension, leadership in the local and national YMCA, and on the executive of the Book and Tract Society. So there were all these organizations which had been, you know, grown up in during this period. They needed leaders, and many of those who had experienced Christian perfection became very involved in them. In Belleville, Jane Clement Jones. Unfortunately, it's hard to get pictures of women. So what we have of Jane Clement Jones is a window that was dedicated to her memory after she died. It's in Bridge Street United Church in Belleville. Jane Clement Jones, during one of James Caughey's revivalist campaigns in 1856, Jane attended. She was 30 years old, pregnant with her fifth child, and she also experienced a new sense of consecration. And what a sense of consecration it was. In the next 38 years, she became a tireless and highly conscientious class leader, first to a group of young women. And after 1869, she took on a senior boys' class, which over its 14-year existence had a total of 770 young men. Young men often came to Belleville. They studied at a school of business. Jane would meet them at the train station. She would bring them to her home. She had special teas which would attract them. And in that way, they became members of her young men's class. As well, she was active in poor relief. She helped establish the Belleville Hospital, a home for the needy, and the Women's Christian Association. And along with this, she was a faithful attendee at Methodist prayer and class meetings, love feasts, and Sunday worships. And of course, she was also a wife to a local businessman and a mother to eventually eight children. Like so many of her generation, I think this is important, she owed a great deal to a meticulous organizational ability and an overly developed conscience. "I would feel guilty if I did not go," she would say, you know, because she spent so much time at her church, which was her second home. In their work on behalf of young people, Colby, Jones, and Morrow exemplified the concern of Methodist clergy and laity to extend the faith to the next generation. This was so important, to make sure the faith was transmitted. And the key institution in this was the Sunday school. Here, prominent local men and women assumed active leadership as teachers and superintendents, although it was the men who were the superintendents. William Pearson, for example, an Anglican in 1852, was converted to Methodism in one of James Caughey's revivals in Toronto's Richmond Street Methodist Church. He worked days in the Toronto post office, but he also served 30 years as the church's Sunday school superintendent. When his church closed in 1888, he joined Metropolitan Methodist Church, where he taught a Bible class for another 24 years, resigning in 1912 after 60 years of continuous Sunday school service. I'm not sure what it would have been like to have been a young child in William Pearson's Sunday school class at the 60th year of his superintendency, but he hung in there. Like other Protestant evangelical denominations, Methodist spirituality began in the home with family devotions. And the results of this are evident in the 1870s, when, as in the 1850s, there was another series of revivals. And Methodist membership in Canada increased from 15.4% in 1871 to 17.2% 10 years later. So, more than a 2% increase, making Methodists the country's largest Protestant denomination. And samples of congregations showed that the majority of converts were children of parents who had been converted during the 1850s revivals. And again, when describing the revivals, the emphasis was on the orderly atmosphere of the revival and on expressions of dedication on the part of the converts. In place of the old-fashioned Methodist class meeting, young men and women were enrolled in Bible classes, which were led by lay female and male members. For the spiritual needs of young people, there was the Epworth League, which was organized in Canada in 1889. Its purpose was to put into active service the knowledge the children had obtained in the Sunday school. For example, the League's Department of Citizenship looked at social and political questions, stressing as the best means of creating a strong and vigorous nation, patriotism and moral reform. And how did you get moral reform? Well, through such means as Sabbatarian and temperance activity, keeping the Sabbath, which was a very hard, you know, we took it for granted many years, but it was very hard to bring that in. What do you do with the trains on Saturday night? Do they all stop? And people would explain, well, if they stop, then the crew is simply going to get drunk on the weekend, and the train will have trouble starting on Monday. So these practical issues that idealistic evangelicals like the Methodists had to deal with. And the Epworth League also emphasized the study of Canadian history and politics. Late 19th century Canadians, as elsewhere in the English-speaking world, strongly believed that theirs was a progressive age, not just in the material sense, but also in the area of religious knowledge. In 1910, the Methodist Church of Canada accepted in a moderate form the new historical approach to the scriptures known as the Higher Criticism. This had not happened without controversy, but in the end it was concluded that both the new and the old readings of scriptures were in keeping with Wesley's evangelistic approach. One of the strongest supporters, theologian and university chancellor Nathaniel Burvosh, argued that questions of biblical scholarship were largely irrelevant for those who concentrated only on the conversion of sinners, such as Methodism's offshoot, the Salvation Army. And Burwash had a lot of respect for the Salvation Army. However, as he saw it, the task of contemporary Methodists went beyond the salvation of the soul to include shaping Canadian culture with the moral and spiritual truths of Scripture. He was convinced that faith in Christ was no longer only a matter of saying, Christ died for me, or Christ paid my debt. Such phrases could easily become ritualized and empty. Rather, faith in Christ meant, said Burwash, the far deeper and broader act of taking him as the Lord and Master, the example and guide of my life. Holiness was not just a personal matter. Those whose lives had been sanctified had a communal responsibility to create a Christian country in every aspect of life, be it politics, education, temperance, Sunday observance, or urban social reform. I'm going to just take a... Henry Rapp, with whom some of you may be familiar, John Wesley's biographer, has noted that over time, John Wesley's legacy of perfectionism resulted in two opposing views. Quote, the two elements held in balance in Wesley, an instant gift and experience, and a steady progress through pious cultivation, tended to split apart into two different versions of holiness. Later perfectionists and Pentecostals concentrated on the gift as an experience with little specific moral content. Others concentrated on the element of gradual progress. Some, such as Burwash's former student Ralph Horner and the holiness tradition, which emerged after the 1870s, emphasized the first version. Mainline Methodists generally highlighted the moral dimension of gradual progress of sanctification or perfect love. So you see this distinction right between the two. and I'm sure you've probably looked at it before in your lectures. In this, in emphasizing gradual progress of sanctification, they were part of a Protestant evangelical moral order that was intent on building a God-fearing nation. Since the 1840s and 50s, Methodists had joined other committed evangelicals, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, Baptists, and some Anglicans, in moral crusades in favor of prison reform, anti-slavery, temperance and prohibition, and Sabbath reform. In the decades after Confederation in 1867, their combined forces and growing political and social influence saw them increasingly seeking parliamentary legislation in support of prohibition and Sabbath observance. In their eyes, the one obstacle to success in making Canada a Christian country by evangelical Protestant standards were the Roman Catholics, who counted for 41.5% of the Canadian population. But during the same time, Roman Catholics had also established a parallel moral order or public religion, especially in Quebec. So you've got this huge public moral order, Protestant evangelical, but in Quebec and amongst some Roman Catholics elsewhere, you've got the same thing, but it's Roman Catholic. Anti-Catholicism had been a feature of British North America from the start. With Confederation, it took on a more nationalistic expression as Protestants and Catholics both started to compete for influence in the new nation. Shaping Protestant fear of Roman Catholic expansion were the well-worn criticisms which I mentioned at the beginning of the talk. And you may remember that central to this was their understanding of sacred presence. Protestants dismissed the exuberant ways Roman Catholics practiced sacred presence. They dismissed it as superstition. Roman Catholics saw Protestant religion as a total denial of a sacred experience and of tradition. What became lost in these verbal wars, except among a few spokespersons, was the reality that during these years, Roman Catholics and Protestants had both drawn on the experience of the sacred, but they had done that in different ways. But they'd both drawn it to build their parallel moral orders. Roman Catholics, like Protestants, held a patriarchal view of the family that rested on the sanctity of marriage and on male authority. Their priests were just as concerned as Methodist clergy to educate the young in the faith. Where Methodists used the Bible to train the child's conscience, Roman Catholics used the Little Catechism. 15% of the Little Catechism was devoted to the sacrament of penance, which was seen as the best way to train the child's conscience. So training of the child's conscience was taking place on both sides of the Christian divide. Internal discipline, social welfare, and the conviction that religion was not only a private but also a public matter were as important to Roman Catholics as to Methodists and evangelicals generally. Roman Catholic lay people were as actively involved in Methodists as Methodists were in poor relief, and they shared a concern to inculcate sound habits like self-discipline, temperance, and frugality. And when it came to helping the state carry out its politics of assimilating native children by teaching them Canadian habits, Roman Catholics shared with Methodists and other mainline Protestants a paternalism, which led them to decide the future of native peoples with good intentions, but without representation and openness to Aboriginal experience of the sacred. Now I'm starting to wind down. But it's a slow winding down. The two faith groups were able to build a parallel moral order in the latter half of the 19th century that lasted well beyond 1925, the year when a number of evangelical denominations formed the United Church of Canada. Observers, even in the 1950s and 1960s, would be struck by the country's high rate of church attendance and religious involvement. Looking back, however, from our vantage point of the early 21st century, we realize that the close fit between spirituality and public life also helped lay the groundwork for the rapid secularization of society that began in the 1960s. There are many reasons for secularization that are far beyond the control of the churches. However, the need to revitalize people's lives with new forms of sacred presence is as real today as it was in the 19th century when the experience of perfect love flourished in Canadian Methodism. But I believe it must happen. It does. It must happen in a vastly changed world. The second half of the 20th century, a century that was torn by two world wars, has proven to be a major turning point in bringing Protestants and Roman Catholics to both acknowledge the importance of a shared Christian experience. And there should be another. Pointing out to the need for a personal experience, Karl Rahner, the German Jesuit theologian who left such a strong imprint on Vatican II, wrote in 1972, it's up there, where men and women have not begun to have the experience of God and of God's Spirit who liberates us from the most profound anxieties of life and from our endless guilt, there really is no point in proclaiming to them the ethical norms of Christianity. What he's saying is Christianity can continue to be ethical, continue to be moral, but if it's not based on the experience of the love of Christ, it really is empty. His words echo John Wesley's emphasis on experience. They're also in keeping with Wesley's own openness to Roman Catholic spiritual and mystical writings, for which, of course, there was little interest in that in the late 19th century among Methodists. They were not interested in whatever positive Wesley found in Roman Catholicism. Today, Roman Catholics such as Thomas Merton, Joan Chittister, and Richard Rohr have become valued guides to many Protestants looking for an authentic Christian experience of God's abiding love. That experience of love now happens in a world vastly different from that of the late 19th and early 20th century. Globalization and official multiculturalism in Canada, the advent of the internet and social media, have not only changed the way we identify ourselves, but also the way we experience God. There are those who point to new developments such as climate change, contact with other world religions, and Aboriginal respect towards nature as evidence that God's love exists far beyond our earlier imagination, the imagination, for example, of the 19th century. One contemporary writer who addresses this is Brian McLaren in The Great Spiritual Migration, How the World's Largest Religion is Seeking a Better Way to Be Christian. And McLaren says, must we stay where we are, forever defining ourselves as a system of beliefs? Or may we migrate to a new understanding of Christian faith as a way of life, a practice of ongoing personal growth and cultural evolution? Wesley, a 19th century Methodist, would agree with his emphasis on Christian faith as a way of life. In the 21st century, we also know that we can't revert to 19th century understandings of, dominion over the earth and violent conflict with those with whom we differ on matters of religion. And so McLaren and others remind us that it is again time for Christians to migrate to an identity that reflects the needs of our time, to move away from the extractive, consumptive, and unsustainable way of life that is destroying our planet and civilization, to look instead to the common good. As do the Roman Catholic writers I've just mentioned, McLaren invites Christians to experience God's perfect love in ways that focus not only on the individual, on a denomination or a country, but on the entire universe and on everything that's in it, on people of different faith or of no faith, animals, the environment, and so forth. He does not say that this revitalization of Christianity will be easy, but then neither were the challenges that Wesley faced in industrializing England, nor those that 19th century Canadian Methodists faced when they tried to live their faith in their time. So thank you very much for listening.